U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
The Florida legislature moves against Disney World in response to the company's lobbying on the state's so-called Don't Say Gay bill. Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal. We're joined today by my colleagues, columnist Kim Strassel and editorial writer Manet Ukwe-Barua. Happy Friday to you both. Disney's Parental Rights in Education Law is the formal title. That's what critics call the Don't Say Gay law. And it has many critics, but perhaps none more prominent than Disney CEO Bob Chapek. Disney employs about 80,000 people in Florida. And last month, Chapek said the bill was a, quote, challenge to basic human rights, unquote. This week, the Florida legislature responded by voting to repeal the Reedy Creek Improvement District, which is a special zone around Disney World that essentially allows the company to run its own government. Governor DeSantis, Ron DeSantis, is expected to sign the bill, and here he is last month pushing back against Disney.
For Disney to come out and put a statement and say that the bill should have never passed and that they are going to actively work to repeal it, I think, one, was fundamentally dishonest, but two, I think that crossed the line. This state is governed by the interests of the people of the state of Florida. It is not based on the demands of California corporate executives. They do not run this state. They do not control this state.
We have a second clip here also of Florida Speaker of the House Chris Sprouls, and he's discussing the Disney vote on Thursday on Fox News.
It's about time that Florida went and looked at these special taxing districts, would have this awesome power. I mean, Disney, a corporation, has the power from the state to build their own nuclear power plant, should they decide to do so. So, you know, after they came out and said what they said, the statements were just totally outrageous. They misled Floridians. They misled Americans about what the Florida legislature did to protect kids in kindergarten through third grade. We started looking at those taxing districts, and today we acted, affirmatively to make sure that in the next year that they will expire.
Kim, what do you make of this battle between Ron DeSantis versus Walt Disney?
Well, the country has been shaping up to have a battle like this. We've seen more and more companies getting engaged in the culture wars, usually at the behest of woke staff. These are often CEOs that are attempting to mollify their own employees, and so they feel the need, either because of that or pressure from the media or liberal elites, to engage in these battles. So obviously one of the most prominent ones was when Major League Baseball pulled its All-Star game out of Atlanta after Delta and others had complained about Georgia's new voting law. Now you have Disney, and interestingly, the CEO, Bob Chapek, originally said he wasn't going to take a position on this, which was probably correct. And as he told his employees, these corporate statements often do very little to change outcomes or minds. That's what he wrote. But then a whole bunch of his employees mobilized and complained, and he decided that he was going to jump into the fray. And states and voters have had enough of it. They want to go to these companies and use their services and buy their products, but they don't want them dictating policy across the country. And in this case, Disney's very powerful in Florida. It figured it could throw its weight around. And the Florida politicians said, you know what? We've done a lot of really nice things for you, special carve-outs like this Reedy Creek Improvement District. If you're going to be fundamentally opposed to what the voters of the state want, then we're not going to do any special favors for you anymore. I think we're probably going to see more of this now happening around the country. It's not necessarily overall a great thing because it can happen on both sides and both ways, but it's another lesson. Companies need to just stick to policies that affect their own bottom line and not a lot of these culture fights.
To my eye, the most important piece of this legislation, which is being lost in a lot of the news coverage, is the effective date. It says it dissolves the Reedy Creek District on June 1st, 2023. And to me, this looks like a brushback pitch, to use a sports analogy, by the legislature. And I say that because getting rid of the district would seem to entail a lot of complications. Just to give people a sense of what it is, it's about 40 square miles. There are four theme parks inside it, and Disney essentially controls land use. environmental protection, utilities, road building for something like 175 miles of roads. And so it's not clear what the financial impact is. The Journal has cites a source, an unnamed source, saying that it saves Disney tens of millions of dollars a year. And I get that Disney wouldn't want to lose that control. How would you like to be the Disney employee showing up to the local building appeals board because you need a variance for the building code to some renovations on Cinderella's castle? On the other hand, without the Reedy Creek District, it seems like a lot of the services would revert to county government. It's not clear that the county is thrilled about that prospect. There's a local reporter at WFTV who is explaining that the Reedy Creek District basically allows Disney to tax itself to pay for the projects within that area. And the county has to tax everybody equally. And so if Reedy Creek goes away, he's saying that property taxes overall in Orange County would have to go up by something like 25% to cover all the services and the pothole filling that happens within the district. So, Monet, I mean, that's why I'm looking at this and looking at that effective date and saying, if the legislature is just saying they're going to kill this district in 2023, maybe they are trying to provide enough time for the governor, the legislature, and Disney to make up and find a happy ending.
I think that's a possible reading. Obviously, Disney does provide a decent amount of economic value in Central Florida. It's the largest employer there. I think it employs about 77,000 people, much more than whoever is second place. And it just would be a logistical difficulty and potentially costly to Florida taxpayers for them to have to pick up the tab, especially for the bonds that have been issued on behalf of the Reedy Creek Improvement District that then would revert to the local county governments. And so, yes, Florida Republicans, including Governor DeSantis, might be hoping to avoid that. But frankly, I think the main reason why they pushed that starting date back is probably because they just want to defer whatever the logistical blowback might be, as opposed to holding out in the hope that they might be able to reach a resolution with Disney and restore the district. And the reason I think that is because they've laid down a really strong political marker here. And frankly, for them to go back to the negotiating table with Disney at this point, unless Bob Chapek comes out and apologizes or retracts his statements about the so-called Don't Say Gay bill, would be a huge failure for Florida Republicans. And I think that looking around the country, they've seen the political damage that has accrued to people like Kristi Noem or Asa Hutchinson, those are in South Dakota and Arkansas, respectively, when they backtracked on some of these culture war bills that were passed through their legislatures. And so I think that Ron DeSantis knew it was a big political step to take this position and say, not only am I going to criticize Disney, but I'm going to pass legislation bound to punish them. But he probably is going to stick with his guns because he's seen a lot of conservatives rally to that cause of showing strength and fighting back against some of these woke corporations. And it really, really would make him look quite weak, I think, to renegotiate that. But you are right in the sense that the financial harm being inflicted on Disney by the elimination of the district isn't huge. As you said, it's estimated that the district is worth to them about tens of millions of dollars. That compares with about $16 billion of revenue that they earn every year from their parks, and that's between Walt Disney World in Florida and Disneyland in California. So it is kind of a drop in the bucket to them. The biggest thing for them is going to be finding ways to delegate those operational tasks back to local government and figure out what the arrangements are going to be there, because that's one of the major selling points of the parks. But I do think that it's better than even money that this provision eliminating the district is really earnestly meant on the part of Florida Republicans and that it's here to stay. And Disney is going to have to find a way around the logistical consequences of that.
So, Kim, that makes you the tiebreaker then. Am I overreading this date more than a year off in the legislation? Or is Monet right that the state lawmakers really intend to do away with the district and then maybe expand on something that you mentioned a moment ago, which is the concern about this kind of what the critics would call government retaliation for corporate speech? I mean, what if there's a CEO in California that criticized something the state legislature was doing and a similar thing were to happen?
So I do agree with you, Kyle, that the date is notable. What isn't clear is if that's because there's some hope for a rapprochement or whether it's just because the logistical aspects of this are so complicated that people understood that it was going to take at least a year to figure out how to reintegrate this district, as it were, into the broader county affairs. And we just won't know that. One thing I would throw in, though, it's a question more than a comment, is I'm not quite sure what that rapprochement looks like. Is Disney supposed to go on one knee and say, we were sorry, we shouldn't have done this, and we take it back? Is it supposed to throw its support in some other way behind some sort of GOP priority? I'm not quite sure how people make amends in a situation like this. But I do think that the whole situation is unfortunate. Look, I put the blame entirely here, though, on Disney and other woke corporations who ought to be sticking to their knitting, and they have refused to. And it's mostly because they've had a lack of backbone, and they're too easily pressed by their employees and by outside forces. And it's just bad policy. But it does lead to this very worrisome situation that you mentioned, where this could become more standard across the country in ways that could be very damaging to companies of all stripes and to the bigger cause of good policy for free markets and free economics. You know, we've already seen a version of this, by the way, on the left. I would note the incredible campaign that was waged for years and still goes on in some places against, for instance, Chick-fil-A, because its founder was a very deeply religious person who put his own money into a lot of causes of traditional family marriage that really riled people on the left. I would note that this is very different. He wasn't lobbying, as far as I know, government in such an open and provocative way as Disney ever was. This was simply a company that existed in its very principles as an organization, offended people on the left. So there were boycotts and bills and other things against it. So we have seen this before. But here's what I fear the most, is that this now has teed up corporate America for retribution, even when it engages in the sort of things that it's long engaged in and makes sense for its company. That's why I used the word bottom line the other day. Corporate America has long been a force for good tax policy, for fewer regulations, for any other number of government policies that has to do with corporations and economics, that for the most part, when they get on the right side of that, we end up with better policy and it's good for them. They are self-interested in a bottom line perspective, and that it helps their company and their shareholders. When they venture into these cultural issues, it opens the gateway for criticism or retribution from politicians for any kind of engagement. And they may end up finding themselves in a harder position to even push for the things that they might legitimately have an interest in, not to mention alienating a bunch of Republicans around the country who may be less inclined to pursue those kind of policies simply because they're angry at corporate America too.
Hang tight, we'll be right back. You're listening to Potomac Watch from the Wall Street Journal.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. I guess I do share some concerns if this is the way that governments are going to respond to corporations when they lobby on political issues. Although to Kim's point before the break, as a matter of political realism, I don't know what Disney expected was going to happen here, and I don't understand why CEOs feel obligated to pick these extracurricular fights. I mean, there are some situations where it's unavoidable if there's a debate going on about a regulation that affects a company, the corporate tax rate. There's a company that owns significant assets in Russia. It's pretty hard to duck the question of what you're going to do when Vladimir Putin starts a war. On the other hand, what we seem to be seeing a lot more of, and this is what Kim is talking about, is pressure internally by employees. You know, what is Jif Peanut Butter's view of voting legislation? Does Fruit of the Loom support net neutrality? And I don't quite get it. These are companies that produce products. Just give me the peanut butter. And that is what Disney CEO Bob Chapek, that was his initial position. What he said in March initially, he told employees, as we have seen time and again, corporate statements do very little to change outcomes or minds. Instead, they are often weaponized by one side or the other to further divide and inflame. And Manet, what is notable about that is the subsequent events have proven that initial stance right, because Disney's lobbying did not prevent this law from being passed by the legislature and going into effect. All it did, it seems, was make a lot of people mad, including Disney's customers and members of the state legislature.
Yeah, I mean, I think you touched on something really important in your comic choice of examples of Jif Peanut Butter and Fruit of the Loom, in the sense that a lot of these companies that are sort of wading into these political fights are commenting on pieces of legislation that couldn't have less to do with their actual business models. And that certainly is true in the instance of Disney weighing in on the so-called Don't Say Gay bill. And so we, from that vantage point, we can certainly say that it was Disney and not the state of Florida that started this fight. They decided to take a shot at laying down a hard marker, try to see if they could use their power to get the Florida legislature to backtrack, and they did not expect the state of Florida to respond. Obviously, nobody thinks it's a good state of affairs for state governments to be in fights against their, you know, their biggest employers. But I think that, you know, we can basically try to carve out what should be the rules of engagement for states when they're trying to push back against sort of action taken on behalf of private companies against their legislative priorities. So I think one distinction that would be really helpful to draw is that they should reasonably be expected to target special favors that have been given to companies when those companies speak out against their legislation, but not target any of the benefits that companies might have as of right. And so in the case of the Reedy Creek Improvement District, that is something that was created, I believe, in 1967 by a piece of legislation that came out of Tallahassee. It's not something that other companies are entitled to. And so for Ron DeSantis to come out and say, well, we've given you this favor, you're benefiting from it, and now that you have involved yourself in this political fight, we're going to reconsider and cancel it, is within the rightful field of play. It would be very different if he were to say, we're going to look into ways that we might pursue some kind of special legislation to harm Disney, increasing its tax rates or subjecting it to some kind of regulatory scrutiny. And so that's something I would hope that we don't see as these fights between companies and governments continue to escalate.
Kim, while we're here, do you want to add anything on the merits of this Florida law on classroom instruction or about the public debate that we've been having now for a couple of months about it?
Sure. I think this is the other thing that is so frustrating about Disney's response to this, because it's so at odds with the general feeling of so many parents who are their basic customers, really. I mean, yes, they may produce content for kids, but it's the parents who choose to let the kids do it. It's the parents who take them to Disney World. And this has been portrayed as Don't Say Gay. Disney just seems to have bought into that under the pressure of its employees. But this is not what it's about at all. As we have written about already, what it does is essentially say that you're not going to have certain discussions about gender and sexual identity taught as a formal product from kindergarten through third grade, and gives some parents more control over what is taught. This is not a bizarre concept to anyone who has kids or who was themselves in school. If you just think about it, those numbers make a lot of sense to a lot of Americans in a broader way, in that, you know, even when I was in school, sex ed generally tended to start in about fourth grade with the discussions of puberty, and then it proceeded from there with things about sexuality and sexual health. And as you got older, you know, more age appropriate material. And most school districts have always understood that this is a very touchy subject for parents, and that, you know, my kids, for instance, there were some classes that were offered in earlier years. The school district in Virginia, where we were, nonetheless made sure the parents were very aware of what the curriculum was, how to get a hold of it, and then to be able to opt your kids out if you didn't want them to be in it. But that has changed. And this is what this bill is a response to, is that increasingly schools have just been imposing this kind of curriculum and not telling parents what it is, and broaching a lot more sensitive topics at much younger ages. And so this was just kind of a response to that. It in no way says you can't say gay at school. It doesn't mean that a child who comes into school and has two dads or two moms can't talk about their family situation, and it might not be brought up in class class, and that was something that could have a discussion, is that we're not going to formally be teaching these kind of very aggressive concepts that are such a fixation of the left right now to very young children.
The one caveat I would throw in is that an earlier version of the bill was a little bit broader. And so when this whole debate got started, the version of the bill that was circulating said that schools, primary schools, could not, quote, encourage classroom discussion, unquote, about sexual orientation. So that's when these critics began saying, what if a kid with a non-traditional family is asked to draw his family and he has two moms in the picture? Is the teacher required to shut down a classroom conversation that begins about that? And the sponsors of the bill, they amended the bill, and now we have a much narrower phrase where it says it bans, quote, classroom instruction about sexual orientation and gender identity. And the sponsor of the bill, it should be noted, was pushing back against the idea that discussion was covered. He said the idea that we would ban a specific conversation a child is having about their parent is impossible, unquote. But Manet, I feel like this is one of those frustrating public debates where the two sides are talking past each other, because conservatives are pointing at that phrase, classroom instruction, and they're looking at videos floating around the internet where a kindergarten teacher says, I make my students pick a pronoun every morning, and they say that is what this law bans. And a lot of liberals are pointing at the earlier language, still citing classroom discussion as what the law regulates. And so, to my mind, part of what will determine the long-term popularity or not of this bill is how it's implemented, because those two visions of what the bill does are essentially predictions. And as the state goes to write the regulations for it, as parents try to sue under it, as the law allows them to do, you know, either it's going to be focused on classroom instruction or it's going to bleed into some of these broader conversations. And I think that's what will determine whether this law is essentially popular in the long run or not.
Yeah, that sounds right. I mean, let's try to imagine how the Parental Rights in Education bill, as it was finally written and signed into law, will actually be implemented. To my understanding, a parent who believes that a teacher has violated the text of the law by teaching a lesson to children below the third grade that's explicitly about sex or gender identity, that parent would then be able basically to file a complaint and potentially have local magistrate sort of rule on whether the teacher stepped outside the bounds of the sort of restricted topics that they weren't supposed to be teaching children. And so that sort of local official would be making that determination. And I think from all of the conversation that has come from the Republican legislators, that has come from Governor DeSantis, what they really are trying to sort of keep out of bounds is exactly that kind of very explicit material that you mentioned parents have been seeing is really being taught in some of these classrooms today, where you do have teachers basically encouraging sort of reflection and conversation about sexually explicit topics that until very recently, almost every parent would have considered to be out of bounds. And so I think that there's a reason to have good faith that sort of Republicans are not trying to shut down any and all presence of, you know, different ideas around sex of any kind in classrooms. We know that, students come from a variety of backgrounds, that these topics are going to emerge. I think it would be very unlikely for teachers to face penalties if their actions were in good faith or if they were simply, you know, mentoring children through some of the issues that they're dealing with in their own households. What it's meant to do is sort of restrict what I think a growing number of parents see as indoctrination, sort of in a progressive cultural direction. But as you said, we're going to have to wait and see how it's implemented before we can come to final conclusions about what the bill's effects will be.
Thank you, Manet. Thank you, Kim. Thank you all for listening. You can email us at pwpodcast@wsj.com. If you like the show, please hit that subscribe button on your favorite podcast app. And we'll be back next week with another edition of Potomac Watch.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at alibabapowersbusinesses.com.